If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Perspectives by John Pierce. I'm your host. Our engineer this evening is James Zebrot. Our topic today is one that we all talk about and think about much, and that is pandemics because of COVID-19. And my guest is Dr. Lindsay Burt from Muhlenberg College, who is going to alert us. The part I like about this, Lindsay, is we're talking not only about the past and what has happened to us in the past decade, but how to get ready for the next time that it hits. And the way you phrase it, getting ready for the next pandemic, does not leave any doubt that there will be another pandemic,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. I'm very convinced of that, John. Yeah. Hopefully not in our lifetimes.
Oh, that's good to think about.
Sure.
Right. Good. Dr. Burt has her Bachelor of Arts degree with honors from the University of Delaware in International Relations. And then she has two Master of Arts from American University, International Development, and from Syracuse University in Political Science. She has a teaching award from Syracuse, Outstanding Teaching Assistant Award, which I congratulate you for.
Thank you so much.
And then from Syracuse Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs, a PhD in Political Science. Her dissertation title, The Road to the United Nations High-Level Meeting on the Prevention and Control of Non-Communicable Diseases. Would you believe I just said all that without looking at my notes?
I don't believe it, John.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's no way I could duplicate that. So she has research and teaching interests in the area of international organizations, global governance, health, international relations, and teaching positions at Muhlenberg College right now. She's a visiting assistant professor of political science. And also, what's the title for the polling?
It's the managing director of the Institute of Public Opinion.
Okay.
That's right.
And then you had a little short of stint at Earlham College.
Well, unfortunately, speaking of the pandemic, I was hired to teach at Earlham College, but that position was canceled when we went into lockdown.
All right, so you never made it to
the classroom. So I never had the opportunity to live there.
Oh.
What a beautiful community it was. I had a great time visiting.
Oh, Richmond, Indiana.
That's right.
All right. Shout out to those folks. And at American University School of International Service. So we're happy that you have found your way to the Lehigh Valley, Lindsay, and now you're going to enlighten us about pandemics and what they mean and how we could deal with a pandemic when it comes along.
That's the hope, John, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here with you.
Good. So what would you say to begin?
Well, I think I would begin by saying that it's a moment in time where we need to make sure we're learning our lessons from the most recent pandemic. We have gotten out of the acute phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 obviously is still with us. We still contend with bursts here and there of increased number of cases, increased prevalence and incidence. But the acute phase is behind us. And so to my mind, this is the moment to be in collective discussion with one another, with our policy experts, with our epidemiologists, with our political actors, to try and envision mapping a way forward to avoid some of the worst outcomes next time we confront another pandemic.
Right. And so are you in favor of inoculation?
100%, yes. Okay. And if the listeners today take nothing else from this conversation, I hope they hear that vaccination works. Vaccination is critically important to keep us collectively and individually safe, that they can trust the epidemiologists and public health experts in that regard.
All right. Is there a time of the year that you prefer to have a flu shot and also COVID? We're still calling it a COVID inoculation.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And also pneumonia, I'm seeing, and whatever we should be taking.
There's a lot out there, John. There's many vaccinations out there.
Yeah.
And certainly in conversation with your doctor and your medical professionals, they can perhaps weigh in better than I can on this. Generally in the fall, in no small part because we know that the winters ahead will be indoors, we'll be in confined spaces, we'll be celebrating the holidays together. I get my flu vaccine and my COVID vaccine often at the same time on the same day. And usually this time of year, in fact, I just got both vaccines last Tuesday, this week.
All right.
So
you're talking October.
October.
Whereas
that's right.
Now it's January. And so we're hoping that folks who are listening have had their inoculations. If not, we're looking forward to this coming fall.
That's exactly
and
right.
Get it done. I sort of like the 1st of November, first week in there as a time. So it will last through the winter.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good target date. And also, I would say it's never too late to get them if you've not gotten them already. Again, in conversation with your doctor, certainly worth considering. I don't think there's ever a wrong time to do it. Hmm. I think it's important to be strategic and think about when it's going to most benefit you seasonally and temporally. That's certainly important. People with pre-existing conditions and people who take medications certainly should be in conversations with their medical experts as to the best timing. And each year we get a new opportunity. Each fall, new vaccines will come out that reflect the latest variants of both the flu and COVID-19. So we can re-protect ourselves each year, which is a tremendous opportunity.
All right. So one of your messages is that these pandemics are here to stay. We're going to be dealing with them, though you said we might not have something as severe as the COVID-19 in our lifetime.
Well, John, I think I said that in the hopes of being optimistic. But of course, it's very difficult to predict when we might see the next pandemic. Things happen very quickly. And in no small part, this is, I would argue, a consequence of climate change, our very close proximity to the environment, the ways in which the environment impacts on us and that we impact on the environment make it possible for things like zoonotic transmission, exposure to mosquitoes and other potential transmitters of disease has increased in no small part because of our changing climate, which suggests to some folks that a disease outbreak might become more likely or more frequent over time. So I would say now is the time, as I mentioned, to be preparing so that we are ready when the next pandemic comes along.
Right. And so is the only preparation that we can do as individuals to be immunized with shots?
I would say at the individual level, we have a lot of opportunities to try and prepare ourselves for the next potential pandemic threat. Certainly, vaccination is key. Vaccination, I think, is a critical part of our toolbox. But one thing that we observed in the context of COVID-19 is that some of the worst outcomes, some of the worst health outcomes, were for folks who were contending with other forms of illness or disease, particularly chronic disease, things like diabetes, things like asthma, things like cancer. We can't always control what is happening around us. And perhaps in the course of this conversation, we'll talk about some of the social and economic determinants of disease, those things in our environment that shape our health outcomes. But as individuals, there are things we can do to try and live the healthiest life we possibly can, given our resources and our genetic composition. And I think given some of the comorbidities that we observed in the course of the pandemic, this is a great time to be talking about how we can collectively prioritize our own individual health and do those things and create environments where people can do those things to try and protect and preserve their health as best as possible.
All right. I assume that this information is this information, not disinformation, is what you talk about in your courses at Muhlenberg College.
Absolutely. Both I and we have a robust public health program. We have some fantastic faculty in our public health program who do talk about things like the social and economic and political determinants of disease, the ways in which our social and economic environments complicate our own individual efforts to stay healthy. For example, we all know that we all need to eat nutritious food and try and participate in daily physical activity. But if you're an individual who's living in what we would call a food desert, where it's difficult to get to a grocery store, perhaps you're dependent on public transportation, or there isn't a grocery store in walking distance, the only thing available to you might be, say, the local corner store or the local deli, which is less likely to have things like fruits and vegetables and maybe protein-rich foods, things that you might find in a bigger, more traditional grocery store. This is a really meaningful way that our living environment can impact on how capable we are to engage in healthy activities.
All right. My guest this evening on Perspectives is Dr. Lindsay Burt, who is talking to us about pandemics and our preparedness for the next one or ones coming along. We've just been through COVID-19, and that was not a fun experience. Many students, I was going to say, lost a couple of years of their education. Not exactly lost, but it wasn't the best for them to have to deal remotely with the professors or with the teachers at the lower level and so on. What besides diet would you say is another way that we can get ready for the next crisis?
One thing that we discuss a lot in public health and in global health when we think about supporting low-income or middle-income countries is the development of what I would describe as a robust healthcare system, making sure that our healthcare system is prepared to serve particularly marginalized or particularly vulnerable communities, but certainly not exclusively vulnerable communities, that it's prepared to serve us all. A robust healthcare system is made up of, for example, a sufficient number of doctors so that folks have access to the care that they need at the time that they need it. A robust healthcare system is comprised of strong surveillance systems so that when new diseases potentially emerge, that information can be communicated to all of the folks who need to be in the know about it. So thinking about developing robust healthcare systems, I think, is a primary component of preparing for the next pandemic. But a lot of people will argue, and I would agree with them, that preparation must be multi-sectoral. To your point, John, you mentioned, for example, education and some of the education loss, for lack of a better phrase, that students encountered in the course of the pandemic. This is a meaningful challenge. And what that suggests is that it's not just our healthcare systems that were perhaps underprepared, but our other social systems as well, including our educational systems. The teachers in my life, and I have many teachers in my life who I love dearly, worked day and night to try and make the learning environment as vibrant as possible for their students in the context of the pandemic. But I think many would make the claim that they were under-resourced and perhaps had been under-trained to try and tackle that in the midst of an urgent crisis when they were also contending with their own pandemic fears and their own pandemic realities. And so when we think about pandemic preparedness, we're certainly thinking about investing in our healthcare systems, but we're also thinking about multi-sectorality. What other dimensions of social life do we need to invest in to try and be as ready as we can should we need to go back into quarantine down the road?
Yes, indeed. And not only the education area, but also businesses. Now, as businesses have permitted their employees to work remotely because of COVID-19, now many of them are saying, hey, we want you to come back to the office because we think that we get better production when folks are together. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense, too, and I certainly would say for myself, I prefer to be in an office environment, and I benefit from those interactions with colleagues. But I think one thing the pandemic highlighted is that some of the ways in which our lives have been structured are needlessly complicated, which is to say, if you're a parent of a small child and you need to get your child off the bus, or someone needs to get your child off the bus, and the cost of childcare exceeds the amount of money that you're earning for the job that you're doing, working from home becomes a tremendously valuable option, perhaps in some cases the only option. So while I agree that there are discernible benefits from being in the office, I think part of what COVID-19 highlighted are the ways in which flexibility can help support those folks who need that flexibility in order to fully engage with all the parts of their life, not just their professional life.
Very good point. Dr. Lindsay Burt is my guest this evening on Perspectives. Her father should be listening now, Dad. Okay, here's a shout out to you.
This is for you, Dad.
There you go. Time for us to take a break. Stay with us, and we will be back in just a moment.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
And we are back. And we're trying to get a mindset, at least, to get ready for a possible next pandemic that could come along. We don't want to scare people into thinking that they have to do extreme things. But Dr. Burt, my guest, is suggesting that there are measures that individuals can take, like vaccinations and eating foods that are nutritional. That helps. And other measures that an individual can take. What about, we haven't talked yet about long COVID. And I don't know anybody who has had long COVID, but what's the deal there?
That's a great question, John. What's the deal is exactly the right question to ask. I think we are continuing to learn every day a little bit more about long COVID. We can certainly think about individual level preparedness for the next pandemic, but what I really want us to continue to emphasize are the ways in which our political systems, our institutions, both domestic and international, can support pandemic preparedness. And to my mind, this is where continuing to invest in science becomes main priority. When we think about long COVID, there's a variety of symptoms. There's been a tremendous number of different sort of personal recountings of types of experiences, degrees of complications, the nature of what folks have confronted and endured can be very individual. And what that suggests to me is that we have a long way to go in trying to completely understand the dynamics of long COVID and what its implications will be at the individual and broader level. Certainly, long COVID makes it difficult for the individual to fully engage in the various dimensions of life. And I think collectively, that implies healthcare costs, loss of productive work years, and other things that impact us at the social level. This is where I'd like to see political institutions say, let's continue to invest money in scientific exploration so that we can fully get our head wrapped around this.
Right. Does long COVID mean that a person cannot go to work, cannot leave the house, is bedridden?
That's, I think, what I mean by a tremendous variation in experiences. For some people, long COVID simply means a prolonged experience of COVID, which means that perhaps they continue to feel symptoms for additional months after the initial acute infection. For some people, long COVID can mean cognitive challenges, neurological challenges, cardiac challenges, and it can be much more pronounced. And again, there's a huge amount of variation in individual level experiences. Some people will recover and go on to live full and complete and normal, in quotations, whatever that implies, lives. And for some people, it can be truly debilitating.
Well, let's talk about what's happening internationally. And now we're
right.
Going into the area of the World Health Organization, or WHO. Huh?
Yes, so, that's a joke my family makes every opportunity they get.
What's
John.
The joke?
They simply say WHO like an owl whenever we talk about World Health Organization.
so you give them lectures when you're together with the family?
I like to think of it as conversation. They might think of it as lectures, for sure.
So the World Health Organization was founded in 1948.
That's correct.
And there are 194 member states grouped into six regions. It's not a part of the United Nations.
It is a United Nations affiliated body. So it has a high degree of autonomy, but is certainly closely associated with the United Nations.
And you have said that it is under-resourced.
I would argue that the World Health Organization is under-resourced. And this may be a controversial political opinion, in no small part, John, because a percentage of World Health Organization's resources come from individual states, individual countries. So the United States contributes to the World Health Organization, France contributes to the World Health Organization, and Rwanda contributes to the World Health Organization, right? Every member state devotes some very small percentage of their own budget towards funding WHO. WHO increasingly also gets funds, what we call extra budgetary funding, from other organizations, philanthropic organizations like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, increasingly comprise a percentage of WHO's budget, which is a tremendous opportunity to continue to resource what I would consider to be a very important organization, but also can be complicated because sometimes those donations come with expressed preferences as to how that money should be used.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what is the WHO doing right now? It has a proposal out.
Yes.
To whom does it propose?
That's a great question. To all of us, John, I would say it proposes.
To all the member states?
To all the member states, yes, that's exactly right. So the World Health Organization has a committee, an international body, that has been working for the last year on a draft of the International Treaty for Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness, and Response, what we colloquially refer to as the Pandemic Treaty. The objective of the pandemic treaty is to coordinate an international response, to plan for and coordinate an international response in advance of the next pandemic, to take a look at some of the failures of a global response or global level institutional failures and try and anticipate how we can correct those in advance of the next pandemic.
Was COVID-19 a complete surprise? I mean, it was to me as an individual.
I think it depends on which communities you're speaking to. I think a lot of scientists and epidemiologists would argue that they tried to sound the alarm for years that a pandemic could come along that would have really significant and substantial consequences. I think the challenge of planning for the pandemic in some ways is similar to the challenge of trying to remediate the maleffects of climate change, which is to say it feels like something down the road. It feels like something very far away, something abstract. In global health, we're often thinking about those conditions that are most immediate and have the most immediate malefacts, things like malaria, things like polio, things like Marburg, right, that are threatening in real time. And this consumes resources. It consumes intellectual and other kinds of attention. And that can shift our focus away from thinking about long-term planning for things like a pandemic, which is, I think, a very normal reaction. But in this context, I think would be a missed opportunity.
Right. I don't know if it's the last pandemic before COVID-19 or the last serious one in the 20th century was 1918.
So the 1918 flu pandemic is certainly on the list of most substantial global level health crises in the 20th century, for sure. I would argue that HIV/AIDS should also be on that list. How people talk about HIV can sometimes reflect pandemic language and sometimes not, but it certainly was a new disease that emerged and quickly became sort of unmanageable, quickly became a crisis, and also an example of the ways in which some of our political institutions failed to mobilize quickly enough to try to do what they could do to prevent the worst outcomes there.
There was a plague back in the 14th century called the bubonic plague, which apparently killed 20 million people, or one-third of the world's population at the time.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So that goes way back into history. That's probably not the first pandemic there ever was, but is that the first one we know about, or we have any statistics about it?
I think what's notable about it, first of all, was the scale. The bubonic plague, or what people often refer to as the Black Death, lasted for 30 years, 30 plus years, and had fits and starts, times that were worse and times that were a little bit better. But mass casualties implications of the bubonic plague are in part, I think, why it stands out. Certainly not the first pandemic in history, but notable in terms of its malefacts. And the really terrible consequences. Also notable, though, in the sense that we start to see collective organizing and collective response that follows from the Black Death. And one example of this is the emergence of quarantine, where folks who were coming into different ports, who'd been out at sea, coming from places where it was clear that bubonic plague was active, were forced into quarantine, had to stay on their ships or had to stay in a controlled environment for the first 40 days once they'd arrived to try and mitigate the spread of disease. So you start to see the emergence of policies, of regulatory action to try and mitigate the spread of the Black Death.
Well, and then not to speak of pandemic, but to speak of simply illnesses, the folks arriving at Ellis Island in the late 19th century were tested to see about their health. And if they were too ill with certain illnesses, they were rejected. They could not come into the U.S. at that point.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We see in Rwanda, again, this is our conversation is happening in October, but we do see in Rwanda the Marburg virus is currently spreading. And in an effort to kind of contain spread, Marburg folks who are traveling to the United States from Rwanda currently are tested on arrival to make sure that they are not ill with that condition. So you see those kinds of techniques and interventions develop, and they tend to hold up over time. Those regulations may shift and take different forms. There might be pushback here and there. But for the most part, I think those are some of the lessons that we've learned from other health crises.
When historians look back on this time that we're living right now and think about the COVID-19, do you think they're going to say that, well, COVID-19 began, as far as I know, in 2020? Would they say that it's ongoing now? We're 2024, 25? And on going forward, or would they say that it was over at the end of, say, 2024?
I think they will describe it as what we call endemic, which is to say it's become part of our more routine, for lack of a better word, disease cycle. The flu is another example of a condition that is endemic. It's part and parcel of the human experience. We know that it's out there. We know that it continues to be a threat. I would say that COVID-19 can be distinguished from the flu still to the extent that the malefacts for at the individual level can be worse for COVID-19 if you have other comorbidities or coexisting conditions. But it is, I think, increasingly describable as endemic, as just a condition that we need to learn to live with.
All right. Well, I don't know if that's a hopeful statement on which to end our conversation, but you deal with some serious matters here, Dr. Lindsay Burt, who is professor at Muhlenberg College. She's assistant professor of political science and managing director of the Institute of Public Opinion. Dr. Burt, our time is up. It goes quickly when you have a conversation like ours. We appreciate your coming over to WDIY to enlighten us.
Thank you so much, John. I enjoyed it.
Very good. Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Thank you, James Zebrot, for being our engineer this evening. And remember, until we meet again, to be gentle with your neighbor.